Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the difference between what is legal and what is right? Which is the higher standard? And what happens when most members of society decide to take the lower road? My guest this hour believes we are experiencing the devastating answer to those questions right now in the form of the deep recession brought on by the collapse in the financial system. And he says the only way to really protect ourselves from more of the same in the future is to build a culture of integrity in which corporations and the individuals who run them are encouraged to consider what is proper as important as what is profitable. Rushworth M. Kidder is president and founder of the Institute for Global Ethics and executive editor of Ethics Newsline. His new book is called The Ethics Recession, Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis. Rush, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
What is the ethics recession?
It's basically what we're experiencing right now. This thing started out last summer, I think, as a financial recession, as most of them do, and the conversation was all about wealth and money and markets and all that. I make the case in this book that sometime around October, everything began to change, and the conversation shifted as well, and we began seeing this not simply as a question of money, but as a question of values, not simply as a question of markets, but as a question of irresponsibility, greed, lack of integrity, and increasingly, that is the conversation that Americans are having about the causes of this particular issue. This is much more than just a financial question.
Where are the differences most extreme in the 21st century between what is legal and what is ethical?
Well, you know, I think we're seeing them right now. That's a very good question, and we're seeing them right now in this particular financial market. We've noticed here at the Institute, the Institute for Global Ethics is a 20-year-old organization, nonprofit, non-sectarian. We do a lot of work with corporations, and we have noticed over the years that, sadly enough, the financial sector has been peculiarly resistant to the ethics message. Now, sometimes that's couched in very nice terms of saying, well, we're already so heavily regulated, you see. We don't really need ethics work in what we're doing, and we are therefore highly ethical. The distinction then arises really between law and ethics. And what we're hearing increasingly these days in some sad ways is this old mantra that if it ain't illegal, it must be ethical. And, mm-hmm. and we're trying to help people distinguish those things. Law is about what we have to do. Ethics is about what we're called upon to do, even though it is unenforceable. Even though the law is silent, there is still the moral obligation to say this is what is right, as opposed to this is what has to happen.
I wonder if you can give some perspective on the issue of AIG right now, saying, look, we don't want to be paying these bonuses, but we are contractually obligated to do so. And a lot of Americans feel like they are morally obligated not to pay bonuses to the people who got them into the very serious crisis that they're in right now. How do you start to unpack the ethics in a situation like this?
Well, go back to this idea of the distinction between law and ethics. There's a great phrase created by a British parliamentarian in 1924, a man named Lord Moulton, who simply described ethics as obedience to the unenforceable. Hmm. Now, for the most part, the ethics structures within our corporate world and within our education centers and all of that has focused on the idea of compliance. Here are the regulations. The ethics officer is there to make sure that we fulfill the regulations. If we don't fulfill the regulations, there will be some penalty, of course, because these are our laws. What we're trying to help people understand here is that while those are an important part of what we do as a culture, the really important questions, Chris, that you and I engage in as we run into ethical issues are not matters of right versus wrong. You and I aren't normally tempted by a dilemma that says, over here's the wrong thing to do, over there's the right thing to do, and, gee, I just can't decide which to do. The real temptations that we face, the real conundrums we get into, come because that side is right and this side is right. And we can't do both at the same time. Now, I put that out there because I think we need to move to that kind of a structure to understand the AIG situation properly. This is not, as much as Congress would love it to be, as much as some parts of the American public would love it to be, a right versus wrong decision where terribly bad people are doing awful things. That doesn't quite do justice to it, because the other side of this is that there really are employment contracts that go back several years that promise the people who signed them and the company that, that signed on its behalf promise to pay a certain thing at a certain date. Now, as much as we don't like the fact that those contracts for pay are there, they actually are there. And we would do grave damage, it seems to me, to the whole structure of the way that we operate as a culture if we simply decided, well, this is a real crisis, therefore contracts don't count. We've got to do whatever we can to preserve the notion that when people sign on the line, when we give our word for things, we have committed, we have made a promise. I think, in other words, there's probably a better way through this question of the bonuses at AIG than simply saying, force the company to refuse to pay them, if you see what I mean.
Do the people who stand to receive that cash have an ethical obligation to at least consider turning the money down?
Yes, and that is exactly what we're talking about. If we can move this to something that goes beyond simply an enforceable legal question into a profound moral question, here's where we're getting on some interesting ground. I would think that they would certainly have that obligation, as basically the heads of, the, of various firms, including AIG's own head, have done in saying, I'm going to take a dollar a year, that kind of thing. I'm going to go forego my pay for this period because this is too important. I would hope that you would find a significant, maybe it's only a significant minority, I would hope it would be a majority, of people in that situation who said, look, we really are in the hot seat here. We have an we have some obligation to the American public to set the kind of standard for the sort of culture we wish to live in. And here is what I, at least, am willing to do. Even if one or two of those people were to say that, I think it would be such an astonishing and interesting statement to the rest of the world that it would make it increasingly difficult for others to say, absolutely not. I never earned this, but I'm taking it.
How did our ethics go so off track as a culture?
You're full of good questions today, aren't you? Well, you know, let me say a little bit more about this ethics recession that we're in. We, and I come from this from a background in journalism. Journalists left to their own devices have two default languages they fall back on, and you see this all the time in the newspapers. You see it on your own program, I'm sure. Left to our own devices, we typically talk about stories either through the language of politics or the language of economics. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean we're either asking the question, where's the power, or where's the bottom line? Those were the languages that, that journalism used and that the public was happy to use all through the summer as this recession began. That was the language actually that Hank Paulson was using when in late September he began negotiating the bailout with Congress. It was about power. It was about who had the influence and all those sorts of things. You roll into October, and all of a sudden you see Alan Greenspan coming before a congressional committee and essentially saying, and this is a paraphrase, not his language, essentially saying, look, 50 years of settled conviction on my part about what constitutes a good economy has just been shattered. I no longer feel the way that I once felt. I am, and this is his word, shocked by what has gone on. And what followed in that was language which could really only be construed as a moral language. He was no longer talking about where's the bottom line, and he certainly wasn't talking about where's the power. He was asking a third question, and that question is, what's right? That's the language of ethics, and that's the language we're moving into. Now you're, I say that as background for your particular question. You said, how do we get to this situation? And I think very quickly there are several things to point to. First is we have come through in the sort of mid-60s on through the early 90s, a long and dark period of what philosophers describe as ethical relativism, the notion that there really isn't any standard out there, there aren't any values except what I happen to believe are the values, and therefore ethics is situational, it's negotiable, it's up for grabs, it's however you want to think about it. We drove that so far into our thinking and into our educational system that, in fact, in primary and secondary school education in those years, there was a word for it, and it was described as values-neutral education. Hmm. And it was a word of great approval. This is what you had to do. This is what you were supposed to do. You could not talk values in the classroom because that would only mean the teacher was imposing his or her values on this poor little innocent student. So all you could do was to clarify values and get into the values clarification movement that basically said, well, I don't have any view about whether a particular value is right or wrong, children. I just want you to articulate what your value is. So if I find little Johnny beating little Sally over the head with a dictionary, let's get into a conversation about why Johnny feels that way and why he thinks that's a right thing to do, without necessarily any statement about saying, Johnny, that's wrong. That's simply not a right thing to do. We allowed this kind of moral relativism, and we rooted that, by the way, in all kinds of things. I mean, people took Albert Einstein as their source. You know, the notion that, well, gee, here's the theory of relativity. Everything in the physical world is relative, so I guess everything in the moral world is relative. You know, and there aren't any standards. Well, for goodness sakes, the last thing Einstein was saying is that there aren't any standards. He was saying there are standards out there of which we have no ken, but he wasn't saying there are no standards. And I think that had a lot to do with where we've gone. There's been a powerful character education movement that has begun to come into visibility at the end of the 90s and on into this period. And we're beginning to turn things around, but there's a great legacy back there of that kind of ethical relativism.
Well, you know, it's really interesting if you think about, you know, this time that we've gone through of ethical and moral relativism, coupled with what in the past decade or so seems to have been a great decline in our tolerance for ambiguity in labeling things either right or wrong. You talk about this question of comparing what is right with what is also right and finding the best course. That's not something that a lot of Americans have been comfortable discussing of late.
No, it's not. And actually, I don't want to pillory your entire profession, but there are parts of your profession on the commercial talk radio which is probably about as bad as it gets in this idea, this notion of an absolute polarization of the discourse, which sort of starts with a premise of saying, look, if I'm right, what could you possibly be but dead wrong? And therefore, I don't even have to listen to you. I will shout you down until, you know, you can speak no longer because you're wrong and I'm right. You don't run a democracy on that kind of a premise. You're absolutely right to pick out this as one of the huge and difficult issues that we're up against. And yet I think what's happened with this is that as the world becomes increasingly complex, there's a longing for some kind of harmony, for some kind of standard that we could repair to, if only there were something I could hold firmly to. And when somebody comes along and says, I've got it, because I know exactly what's right, and here's what we've got to do. People who are exhausted by their experience with reality and unwilling to think more deeply about it than they've been able to, sort of roll over and say, "Okay, you're the dictator. Okay, you're the boss. Okay, I'll go along with you." It's a dangerous trend, and that's one of the reasons that we're so interested here at the Institute in helping people build an understanding that nuance is not a bad thing, and that really tough dilemmas can be sorted through. There are frameworks. There are ways to get at them, and that's what we spend our days talking to people about.
My guest this hour is Rushworth M. Kidder. He is president and founder of the Institute for Global Ethics. We're talking about his most recent book, which is called The Ethics Recession, Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis. You can join us online by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. If you want to check out the website that Rush works at, you can look at globalethics.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rushworth M. Kidder, president and founder of the Institute for Global Ethics. His new book is called The Ethics Recession, Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. A lot of people would like to talk at this point about starting over. But the reality, Rush, is that we can't start over entirely. We're forced to start with where we are right now. Is it ultimately a harder change than rebuilding everything from square one?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we obviously don't have that option, as you've pointed out. No, I think we have to be careful about not overstating the kinds of problems that we're in. I mean, I certainly don't mean this in any kind of a crass way, but even if we arrive at a 10% unemployment figure, it means that 90% of the people are working. And we can't lose sight of that 10% because they're suffering enormously. But there is an economy that's moving forward here. And what I've found fascinating is the ways in which some companies can become counter-cyclical in this how they take advantage of this kind of thing. Chocolate, for example, has long been counter-cyclical. Hershey's has known that for years. People buy more chocolate bars in a depression. And what we've learned, interestingly enough, in the last few months, is that ethics, to some extent, is also counter-cyclical. Crisis invites introspection. And when everything is humming along and people aren't thinking very hard about it and the money is flowing in, one doesn't really have to think as deeply as you do in a situation like this and ask yourself, what are we really about? What are the values that most make the culture that we want to live in? And people are coming down to that kind of a conversation right now. And I think in many ways, that's a healthy sign. It's a difficult sign. It's something we've got to move through. But it doesn't mean that we're in some ways in disastrous shape that is going to leave us, you know, mortally wounded for the rest of our economic life or anything of that sort. I think there are profound things going on right now that are really going to benefit the culture.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Herb in Dallas. Hey, Herb.
Hello. I wanted to comment on what you said earlier about it being unethical to ask the executives of AIG to renegotiate their contracts. And I don't disagree with that, but if that's the case, why is it not unethical for us to ask the union workers that are having to renegotiate their contracts at General Motors and the other automakers? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, very good question. Thank you for bringing me back to the AIG thing, because I think that's something that we do need to talk a bit more about. First of all, it would seem to me that you're, in many ways, with workers in General Motors, you're talking about something going on into the future. What are we going to have for our next year's contract, and how is it going to work that way? Yes, we've had a model in the past, but the reason they're renegotiating is that the contract is over, and we got to do a new one. These contracts at AIG aren't over in that sense. What I found fascinating, and I have no idea whether it's going to work or not, but there are now, just today, have been surfacing ideas in Congress about saying, yeah, let them go ahead and pay the bonuses. We at Congress are working hard on legislation that will create an excise tax that will recapture 91% of any bonus paid to an AIG person, with federal money. That's a different way of going at it, and it doesn't tear apart. It doesn't rip the core out of the whole notion that a contract has validity. It simply sets up a very onerous tax burden for certain kinds of contracts. I don't know whether that's going to fly. It's going to get a lot of flack. But at least it suggests that there's some creative thinking around the edges here that could very well put enough pressure on individuals in AIG to say, look, I don't want to be the bad guy. I don't feel like the bad guy. And I realize things have not gone right. I'm willing to change my view. I'm handing back the bonus.
Well, it is an interesting idea. I wonder, though, if you can talk about what you see as the limitations of using legislation and regulation to impose a system of ethics, as opposed to trying to cause people from within themselves to have a sense of integrity and responsibility for their own actions and the things they agree to.
Yeah, excellent, excellent point. By its very definition, once you begin to legislate something, it's not ethics. It no longer is obedience to the unenforceable. It is obedience to the enforced. And that's why I find in so many, we've got a lot of mistaken language floating around the place in Washington. I really don't think the Senate Ethics Committee, for example, is any such thing. I don't think it has anything to do with ethics. It has to do with regulation. It's saying, look, if a law was violated, we're going to find the senator guilty and we're going to fine that person or do whatever we do. But if all that senator has done is do something unethical, well, we don't have much to say about that because we can't find a law that covers it. You're absolutely right. If we're not going to move through this simply by putting in place more regulation. We learned that lesson to some extent in Sarbanes-Oxley. And if we try to go back and simply re-regulate all of these structures without at the same time putting into place some powerful canons of our culture about the need for responsibility and fairness and so forth, we're not going to make much progress.
We have an email from Bill in Dallas who asks, if the United States is such a religious country, why hasn't the weekly sermonizing that so many people take part in translated into the kind of ethical behavior we find lacking?
Well, I think it's trying to, and I think there are people who are willing to take that position, and it can move forward in all kinds of useful ways. The danger is that some of the sermonizing, and this is not just me speaking, this is documented pretty well over the last 10 or 20 years, some of it has moved so far in the direction of the black and white, I'm right, you're wrong kind of questions, that it becomes awfully hard for people to stomach. And by that I simply mean that we after all live in a culture which has very properly said, let's separate church from state. And anybody who doubts that we ought to have that separation, just take a look at Iran. Just take a look at some of the theocracies around the world. It's not going to work to try to impose, as though it were law rather than ethics, to try to impose a theological structure on a country. What we need from those who are, in your word, sermonizing, is the kind of careful analysis of situations that says, look, I'm not willing to say flat out this is right versus wrong. I am willing to say there are two rights here, and I have no question about which side I think is the higher right. And let me tell you why I think it's the higher right. Let me analyze until we can understand clearly that doesn't mean the other side is dead wrong. This is the higher right. Those are the tough questions that we get into, and we get into them all the time. We get into them raising our children. We get into them in our education. We get into them in military situations where the law is silent, and yet here's what needs to happen. What do you do in the situation where your employee has done some dumb thing and you have a perfect right to throw the book at him, you know, fire him on the spot? You also have a perfect right to take him out for a cup of coffee and sit down and say, what on earth is going on? In other words, you can go down the justice road, you can go down the mercy road. They're both absolutely right morally. You can't do both at the same time, and you'll never be successful in life, I don't think, if you camp out on one side or the other and refuse to recognize that the other side exists. You're not going to make it through life if it's all justice and no mercy, and the opposite is true as well. Those are the kinds of questions that we need to be hearing more from the pulpit, from our teachers, from our parents, from our government.
Rushworth M. Kidder is my guest. His book is called The Ethics Recession, Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis. Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 and speak with Michelle in Dallas. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi, Michelle, would you turn off your radio, please?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead, please.
No, I just had a question about what his suggestion is for as far as ethics and education. I'm not sure if he answered this already because I was getting cut off a little bit. So how to put education in... how to teach ethics in our educational system. That's it.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call.
Good question, and one that lots of people are struggling with. How do you do it? You don't do it simply by saying, here's what you have to do, and if you don't do it, you're dead wrong. There are really three things we've got to do. We've got to get back to an understanding that there is a set of core shared values that actually Americans share with people all around the world. It is not true, and we've done plenty of research on this here at our institute, it is not true that different cultures have different values or different political parties have different values. What we find when we do this research all around the world is that people commonly gravitate towards five shared values. And when I tell you what these are, this is not going to strike you, Michelle, as rocket science. This is pretty obvious. People come together around the idea that says honesty matters, responsibility matters, respect matters, fairness matters, and compassion matters. Now, those are five different values, and by that I mean it's not enough. We're not going to call you ethical if you're very honest and very compassionate but totally unfair, right? All five have to be there for us to say, yes, this is what ethics is. And that, just that simple realization gives people a way to understand, okay, there is something we can teach here, and we're not going to get into any trouble by people who say, don't teach my kid your values, because these are the values held in common all over. It gives us a definition of what ethics is. It also, interestingly enough, gives us a definition of what ethics is not. And it helps us, for example, in dealing with, I'll say, the teenager who would love to persuade you that he's very responsible, very respectful, deeply fair, and wonderfully compassionate, and therefore he's ethical, even though he's been absolutely dishonest in cheating on this particular test. And we, at that point, have the right to say, look, this ethics, that's not good enough. Ethics is this whole collection of values, and we've got to be able to see it whole. Just an idea like that, as schools begin to work with that, and we work with a number of schools around the country, it begins to have some revolutionary impact on the way that teachers feel free to talk about ethics and the way that kids respond and really understand, yes, this matters. I can see this is important in my own life.
Well, it does seem like one place where schools, with the lack of time and resources that they have, might fall short on this is giving kids a chance to practice these questions that are really difficult to resolve, to look at a situation where there are two or three or more right answers. Is there a way to work that into the curriculum? Does it belong in social studies? Where do you put that?
It belongs in all kinds of places, and what it depends upon are the kinds of dilemmas that the field itself tosses up and that students are interested in grabbing hold of and saying, yes, here's a fascinating issue that I need to think about. Let me just give you a quick example. In a seminar that we did some years ago, a woman said, I'm a reference librarian. I was working the reference desk in my public library one day when the phone rang, and the caller on the other end of the line had a question about state laws governing rape. I asked him a few questions, and then I said, I've got to put the phone down. I've got to hang up and go look this up. I'll call you back. Give me your first name and a phone number. So the man gave him that information, and she went to look up the information. She was just getting up from her desk when a man sitting in the reading room of the library within earshot of her desk came over to the desk, opened up a police detective's badge from the local community, and said, I heard your conversation. Could you give me that name and phone number? Because there was a rape in this community last night, and I think you've been talking to the rapist. Now, everything in that woman's makeup, as a woman, as a member of the community, and as a mother, says, take this piece of paper and go with it as fast as you can and get the guy. Everything in her professional makeup as a librarian says, wait a minute. We don't in this country accuse people just on the basis of questions they ask. We don't give away information about our patrons. We think privacy really, really matters. And as a librarian, she's saying, I can't give that away. You can make as powerful a moral case as you want that the right thing to do is to give the officer that name right there. And you can make as powerful a moral case as you want that you must never give away that name unless there's a search warrant or something like that, because that's your professional duty. That's what I mean by right versus right. Now, you can imagine when you throw a question like that into a classroom of say, 15-year-olds, they're going to go after that the way people go after a puck at the beginning of a hockey game. They're going to devour it, and they're going to be still talking about it when they get out in the hall 2 hours later, if you see what I mean. And you think of those kinds of questions. You think of issues that arise on the sports field. You think of what happens when your star quarterback is caught smoking the night before the game. He's never smoked before, but all of a sudden he's there. Do you throw him out of the game? Does the team lose the championship because of that? What's the right thing to do, if you see what I mean? These kinds of questions. when you put people into right versus right situations, you get fascinating, interesting, rich conversation that teaches people what ethics is all about. If your view of ethics is simply, it's about rules, here's what you don't do, kids, you've lost them right there, and there really isn't much conversation left in the classroom.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I can appreciate your guest's efforts to get where he's trying to get us to go, but I'm not sure I agree with the methods he has us going to get there. First of all, I'd like to correct something that was said earlier. You spoke of a 10% unemployment rate means 90% of people are working. Well, I would say 10% unemployment means about 75 to 80% of the people are working, because it doesn't account for the so-called discouraged workers, people who would prefer to be working, like the ex-convicts, but who have given up trying because
sure,
they're
fair point. Yep.
So told no so often. Secondly, I would say that I think that at the root of our current crisis, ethical crisis, lies in this profound excess, of materialism. And this gets me to a disagreement with something you said earlier about, well, we can't go back to scratch. We can't start over. Well, I think we can, and we probably should. How do we do that? We should pull the plugs on the Wall Street banks and investment houses, because they are the ones that are putting up the money to fund the credit card companies that tell us that you got to have new clothes, you got to have a new car to be somebody in our society. And they're the source of that sneering look you get at the grocery store parking lot when you pull up next to somebody in a brand new BMW and they look down at you because you're driving a 10-year-old American-made car.
Ed, we need to take a break right now, but we will get a response from Rush for you after the break. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Rushworth M. Kidder is my guest. He's president and founder of the Institute for Global Ethics. His new book is called The Ethics Recession: Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rushworth M. Kidder, who is president and founder of the Institute for Global Ethics. His new book is called The Ethics Recession. To summarize the call that we had before the break, obviously expressed a lot of the kind of frustration that many people are feeling, and ultimately sort of asked about the moral culpability of corporations for creating a culture of overconsumption.
It was a great question, Ed. The whole idea of materialism is front and center in this conversation. It has to be. I guess my only concern is whether the answer to somehow come down on the corporate sector itself as though they were the only ones, or is it going to require something tougher than that, something harder for all of us to do, which is to have the moral courage in our own lives to say, okay, this stuff that we're accumulating, this notion of a material universe, is not really what it's all about. There's something bigger there. Now, we've fallen into this trap, it seems to me, for some reasons that are complicated and in some ways demographic. I remember speaking to a man who's a demographer who graduated in he was a student of the baby boom, basically. That was his research. He graduated and came of age in the mid-30s, and he said the experience of somebody in my generation going to seek a job was that you walked into a room by yourself, there were three or four executives sitting on the other side of the table, and their response was, "You want to work? Wow, that's great. Come on, we need you." The experience of the kid growing up in the baby boom is that you walk into that same room with 400 other kids, and there's only one job. And what that forces all of us to become is, you know, that's where we get the sharp elbows out, that's where we become competitive, that's where we say, this is all about me, looking out for number one, that kind of thing. And what's more, because we've grown up with this as the baby boom, we don't think this is strange. We think this is life. And demographers have been telling us for decades the baby boom is one of the weirdest phenomena that ever happened in the history of the world. There's nothing like it in the past, and there probably won't be anything like it out there in the future. And yet those of us in the middle of it say, this is life. My point here is to just suggest that this intense sense of competition that we've allowed ourselves to develop, this notion that we're in this, we're against each other rather than cooperating with each other, has its ultimate payoff in many ways in a form of materialism, because that's how you keep score. If you've got the BMW, you scored higher than the next guy. And remember, this is all about scoring. I mean, that, in a sense, is what the pressure of demography has done to our culture. We don't have to put up with that. We can recognize that, and we can say, wait a minute, there's a better model out there than this intensive, destructive, competitive system that we seem to be in. But it's going to take a huge amount of courage on the part of individuals to do that. And we can get some relief, I suppose, by controlling the corporations, but frankly, that's not where the issue comes from. We can't blame this on anything but our own sensitivities.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Rush, because I think a lot of people do now look at the culture of materialism and feel rightly that they have been victimized by it. But do you sense that there's a willingness on the part of Americans to say, I also made a choice, whether or not it was a conscious choice at the time, to take part in this culture and to not resist it when I could have sort of saved myself from its excesses?
I think increasingly that's so, Chris, and I think that's what encourages me about what's going on here. I am not in favor of this recession by any means, but I am noticing that the introspection that is building up here has caused a number of individuals to now say, without any sense of shame, look, I've given up what I used to do. I'm no longer going on those vacations. I no longer spend this way. I'm leading a perfectly comfortable life, but it isn't excessive, and we're beginning to find a way to do that, and we're finding it just in time, and we're getting a wonderful lesson from the environmental movement as well, because the Earth itself is beginning to give us that message, and it's we're finding some solace there from people who for a long time have been saying, couldn't we just begin to cut back a little bit? I went to a conference the other day. One of the things that they handed out to all the people in attendance was a shower timer. It's a little hourglass, and you stick it on the wall with a suction cup of your shower, and you flip it over, and it gives you 4 minutes to take a shower. I don't think I can take a shower in 4 minutes. I don't think I ever have. And yet there's a pressure now out there to say, well, can I at least bring it back to 6 or 7 or something like that? And frankly, I hadn't given that much thought before this little item came along. I think we're all beginning to rethink that, and that's a hugely healthy response.
Is it permanent, or is it just a factor of the reality that so many people are feeling squeezed right now?
Oh, that's a terribly good question. You know, I wish I had the answer to that. It will be permanent for some people. It will be permanent to the extent that we can begin to say to ourselves, you know, it's terribly important to raise a next generation of ethical individuals, but we've got, in the end, to create cultures of integrity. We've got to make sure that the entire organizations in which we work make it easier for us to be people of integrity, not harder. That the standard there within families, within communities, is about us rather than me, and we need to be making those shifts to hopefully make it permanent. And I'm very encouraged, I must say, by what I see in the coming generation, the millennial generation, and the survey work that's been done around that, suggesting that these are people who actually have a rather different take on the question of values from some of the adults that raised them, and it looks to be a superior take on values.
Let's go next to Garland and speak with Lisa. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Go ahead.
All righty. I would like to ask the guest about situations where the person in power and those and the culture that he governs those people actually engage in acts that are knowingly deceptive or complicated or seedy or plain out wrong. Those people, I feel, tend to have no remorse and or sort of have this mentality more than what you talked about, this competitive streak, but more of a lines of sociopathology or people that really aren't able to be redeemed because if put in that situation before again, they will do the same thing. Because of I work in a middle class. I'm a middle class worker, and the people around me, and I'm in my 40s. We've always had a sense of personal responsibility and ethical behavior about us, and the people that I associate with, and the people that I hear about also do. It's those ones that are in higher powers who tend to take these risks that where the reward, when the payoff is only awarded to a certain select people, and be damned the rest of the economy. So I want to get your
I take your point. It seems to me that one of the things that I've been most impressed by as we've moved through these last 20 years is a growing interest in this idea of transparency, that we need to be able to see clearly into what's going on. We've got to uncover the dark corners where these kinds of acts that you're talking about begin to arise. And in that sense, we need to be willing to take action, have the moral courage to take the action that's needed when these kinds of things happen. So loving the idea of transparency, I'm also deeply concerned about the fact that we appear to be losing our news media resources. The newspapers, the journalists in a community whose task has always been to expose those kinds of things. And what I worry about is that if we allow our sources of information to dry up in this way, if we're not willing as a culture to fund the kind of investigative reporting that brings these things to the surface, frankly, you and I wouldn't even be having this conversation right now because you wouldn't have known any of that stuff was going on. You'd see a society struggling, but you wouldn't be able to say, and here's why.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Herschel in Dallas. Hi, Herschel.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, my question, or rather comment, is public media is probably the greatest polluter in our society because, of course, a lot of it is owned by big corporations whose, you know, ethical considerations are probably the bottom line. And isn't ethics passed on sort of by osmosis through the fact that many commentators will report news of horrible events with the same tone of voice as good news? And doesn't this desensitize our society? I will quote Norman Mailer. Many years ago, he gave a lecture at the University of Texas. He said, programming should not be allowed to be determined by the sponsors. I'm thinking perhaps we should elect our program directors. I haven't worked out the details, of course, but what does he feel about this?
Thanks, I think you're on to something, Herschel. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago looking at the future of the new media. One of the things we were talking about was, is it possible to have a media run in a nonprofit way? You know, we have never demanded of our art museums that every fifth slot on the wall where there should be a picture is in fact an ad. We've never demanded that in the middle of a symphony they're going to stop every 12 minutes and bring you news from your sponsor. We said there are certain things that matter here and that we as a public ought to get together and support. Why can't we have nonprofit newspapers? Why can't we find ways to say, look, the news in a democracy is so vital that it has got to be supported? Now, fortunately, we're in that milieu right now with National Public Radio. And you look at NPR, you look at BBC, and you realize, hey, there are ways to do very good news reporting that don't depend on advertisers. This is the kind of new thinking that we've got to do. And just to bring it back to our sort of theme here, one of the things that happens when the economy really gets into the trouble that it does is people are willing to think in new ways that they were never willing to do before because it was just too comfortable and they didn't have to. We have to now. And I think we're going to find some very interesting answers as we move forward.
Let's go next to Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment, I'm going to change it a bit. A gentleman mentioned earlier about the churches and their lack of teaching with regards to materialism. The teachings are there. Most folks just don't want to listen to it regarding 10% was supposed to go to Caesar. Granted, Caesar gets a little more than 10% nowadays. Another 10 to the church and another 10 to savings. And, of course, 10 to the church, put it toward a good church or to a hospital or somebody else you care about. But when you take 30% out of your income and force it into the community and into your savings account for safety and to help others, you can't help but look after your own dime. And in turn, it gives you a sense of self-worth and gives you the ability to turn down the tug that materialism has for you to own that Beamer when you don't really need it. And that's all I had to say. And thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, there is a long tradition, clearly, not only in Christianity, but in most of the major religions, about this question of what are we to do with the material world? What are we to think about this? How are we to relate to it? How do we make sure that we keep the spiritual things, or in terms of our conversation, the ethical things, front and center, without ignoring the fact that we all have to eat and survive? So you're right. There's the teaching is there, and increasingly what I find, and what I find interesting in the response to this book, is that there are an awful lot of people out there who understand, yes, indeed, we have come to a point where ethics has driven us around the corner into this recession, and this isn't going to be solved simply by tinkering with the financial relationships and the regulations. This one, we're going to have to go deep to solve, just in the way that Mark was talking about.
How do we demand ethical behavior of the businesses that we have no choice but to patronize?
Well, I'm not sure that demand is the right word. I think what we do is set up the kind of the situation where we've got more options and businesses want to behave in that way. We work with a great number of businesses around the country, small and large, and we hardly ever work with the ones that are in terrible ethical shape. We work with ones that come to us and say, look, we understand that if we want to keep our market and really, really benefit our community and ourselves, we have got to be behaving in increasingly ethical ways. You're talking to me now, Chris, in the state of Maine, and one of our great employers up here is L.L. Bean. Everybody in Maine has an L.L. Bean story, and they're all good. They're all stories about customer service and about going back with something that you bought 10 years ago and it's finally broken and you don't have the receipt any longer, and they don't sell it. They sell a slightly less expensive model, so they'll give you the thing that they've got plus a check for the difference between what you paid 10 years ago.
Sounds like a good way to do business.
Yeah, and people flock in because it is fundamentally ethical.
Rushworth M. Kidder is the author of the new book, The Ethics Recession, Reflections on the Moral Underpinnings of the Current Economic Crisis. You can find him online at globalethics.org. Rush, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.